What is going on? Welcome to the Land Podcast. This is Jake Hofer, and we're bringing you part two with Calvin. If you missed the first part, I encourage you to go listen to it. There's a lot of great value in it. And for part two here, there's even more. We're talking about cost segregation studies in order to help depreciate gains on a different transaction. Neither of us are accountants, so take that for what it's worth. So that's my disclaimer to you. But it'll get your juices flowing. It'll be some creative ideas that you probably haven't considered before. And I hope you guys enjoy this next part with Calvin. Before we get into it, over at Exodus, we just dropped the brand new Live 4K. We just opened pre-orders. And this camera is simply impressive. Some people will call it a standard camera, but I'm going to say it is nothing but standard because of all the features that we've built into this new non-cellular camera. I'm talking dual image sensor, dual lens, native 4K video, just simply the best standard camera we possibly could build. And you can save $50 by using the code 4K, just the number 4, the letter K. Go and do that. Limited supplies for that code, so lock it in. If you're a real estate professional, this is a camera you're going to want for listings. If you create YouTube content, this is what you want. If you are a deer fanatic, which is a pretty high likelihood if you're listening to this podcast, and you want exceptional, breathtaking pictures and videos, this is the camera for you. It's going to be shipping late summer of 2024. Head over to Exodus Outdoor Gear. Use the code 4K. Help support the Land Podcast. Help support Exodus. And get yourself the best non-cellular camera available. In case you're brand new here, the goal for the Land Podcast is very simple. It's to help 100 people buy their first farm. There's three ways to be included on this list. Number one, if you're looking in Illinois in an area I have expertise, I'm more than happy to help represent you as a buyer's agent. Number two, if you want to get connected with someone I would consider doing business with, I'm more than happy to do so. If I don't know anyone in your area, I'm going to let you know. And number three, if you simply learn something from the podcast, helps you move forward, let me know. And I need to sit down and tally up how close we are to 100 because I know we are getting close. We're getting very close. So I need to do that. If you have been on the fence of sending in an email and letting me know, please do so we can get to that 100 goal. When I started this podcast, didn't know how long it would take us to get there, but we're 120 some episodes in and we're getting really close thanks to all of you guys and thanks to the guests sharing their knowledge. So I want to say thanks to everyone. Let's get right into this episode. Here we go.
I've had, you know, like you say, a great farm. Well, how do you guarantee it's, you know, great? What are all the things that mean great? So, you know, even if it has a great trail camera history, great harvest is, I mean, I would, if it's got all of those things, if it's got great access, got all of those things, I tend to find those farms often are just, they're going to be overpriced. Now they're not going to be at market pricing. They'll be over market pricing. I just have a very hard time paying that to absolute top of the market. I'd rather buy the crap, fix it up and make it beautiful and make it into a great farm as best as it can be. And then either, you know, keep it or sell it. I've just had too many great farms that looked the best. I'd be there.
Yep, I got you. We're good.
Sorry about that.
All good. So you were saying you've seen all these different pieces that, you know, have all these things that give attributes and great attributes, and then you feel that it's testing the market or it's resetting what is fair market value for a piece. Do you think that has something to do with just your personality of like you're buying crappy houses and you're making them nice and the stage of your life too? Cause I could see a guy that's like 50 or 55 and he has kids. And at that point I would say buy the great farm at a fair price.
Absolutely.
A young guy that's just getting started. I think that's a good distinction.
I think number one thing I'm chasing is equity. So, you know, I am chasing. So when I see that just junk trailer home on the front of a property, like, great, I know how to remove that. I know how to add value. I mean, just removing that trailer adds value to the parcel, right? A lot of your end buyers don't like problems. So I'm targeting the problem parcels because they're a deal and I know it's economical and I can usually remove the problems. I know you can't remove, you know, good access, like great access with the right wind directions. I know there's only so much you can do on that, but that's when you start calling neighbors and getting access from that other side and suddenly you have phenomenal access. Mm-hmm. So
there's Pat Porter. He's been on this podcast a handful of times. And something he shared has always stuck with me is people typically don't have imagination, and your job is to remove the imagination, meaning fixing those things. Like, for example, a rundown trailer's on the front of the property. A lot of people aren't going to look past that. They can't picture it without that trailer gone. It's like, it's there. It's fact. But someone like you can say, oh, that's a day job. Hire someone, get rid of it. And now the imagination's removed and it looks a lot better.
Yeah, I do like to look at everything with just a number. You know, it's $4,000 to get that trailer gone. You know, that's just a number. And I like, I mean, you know, timber always plays a huge part of it too. And sometimes I'm wrong on timber. Sometimes I think there's, you know, 40K and there's only 25K. And that's why I always like to, I'd rather almost have a logger walk the parcel than me walk it. But there's always a game to play there too. Cause it's like, okay, you might get a $40,000 quote, but can he actually get on it in any month other than July and August when he's going to be full of great timber contracts anyways? So having a good logger that gives you a quote and tells you when he can kind of guarantee that he'll actually do it, you know, it is good too, because then you're left, you know, I mean, the bad thing about timber is you're often left, even a good logger, it's your property is still going to look kind of crappy, you know, even if he leaves the trail. So you're going to get a better trail system probably, but you're going to get a woods that doesn't look great for a year or two. And then, you know, some of that, maybe you want to cut some tops out, maybe you want to leave them for habitat. You know, so we're still going through all of those things on parcels that we're selling. Is like, okay, we go get our $40,000 worth of timber out. Like, what did we actually cost the property in terms of resale? How long do we have to, you know, wait? You know, are we, most properties we're marketing for the deer hunter, and the deer hunter doesn't typically, like, they want to see some thick cover. They can see some crappy things. As long as they see a really good trail camera history, even a harvest history, food plots, blinds, you know, tree stand setups of multiple wind directions, and kind of check all their boxes, then we've got a good property. So.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever looked at a piece? I got a couple questions. One that comes to mind is, for example, let's say you buy a piece, there's $40,000 of timber value. And have you guys left any of that for the next person and saying, and leaving it as more pristine? Cause I think there's two different ways to kind of cut that. Like, okay, so we have raised $40,000 and we're going to leave that, but we're going to sell for X price. Or, I mean, what's your strategy behind that?
We used to like 14. That's exactly what we've kind of switched to. We used to like 14 inch cuts or even 12 inch plus cuts, like give us every dollar you can, cause we're focused on our own hunting. And more lately we're like, no, let's do a blend here. Let's do just 16 inch plus. Let's even pick out a few, pick out a few oak trees that we want to keep. Let's make sure this property stays beautiful and we're not getting the maximum check. So often we'll get a quote of, you know, 40,000 for a 14 inch plus everything over 14 inches cut. And then it'll be like 28,000 for everything 16 inches and over. And usually that's what we're going to go with, and leave some leave that strong timber value for the next buyer, because that's going to be looked at with a good amount of value.
Mm-hmm. Here's another email I get often, and it's usually after a guest like yourself that owns rental units and everything else. And I think a lot of guys that are maybe in chapter one, meaning maybe they own one rental property already, or maybe they're saving up and they're like, do I buy a rental property or do I buy a piece of ground? What is more wise? And I think it roots down to whatever their personal goals are. But is there anything that if you had to start all over, would you have started buying land sooner, or would you have waited longer to buy land and bought more rental properties? And just think of someone that's kind of just getting started, what you would tell them.
Yeah. Everything I feel like is hard to get into right now. Like everything feels like, I mean, we don't, you know, if we knew what the market would do 2 years from now, we would all take actions. You know, we could all make a ton of money if we knew the future, and we don't know that. And everything feels like it's higher, you know, interest rates feel like they're high, prices feel like they're high. The rental numbers like hardly make sense on residential rentals. Land doesn't, like, you know, it's expensive to sustain land. I mean, you know, you never want to go into an investment absolutely counting on the appreciation. I'd have a very time hard time steering one thing or another. I always believe there's better, probably better cash flow in most, you know, residential rental or commercial rental type properties. I've had some of my greatest appreciation and greatest profitability on land historically. So I've, you know, some of my land deals have been like the best flips. Again, but that's just you know, maybe a good buy and then massive market growth over a year and a half, and you suddenly you've got that just that massive appreciation. So that's a tough question. I mean, I don't I think it depends what other investments, you know, that you have. It's hard for me to look at, you know, buying one, like if I didn't own any real estate, I think I would pursue buying a duplex, you know, before going and buying a hunting parcel.
And why is that?
I think it's, you know, I think your combination of, yeah, I think the appreciation is similar. You'd probably know more than I would on what, you know, what different rates of appreciation in different areas. But I think the combination of appreciation, debt pay down, and cash flow is a better scenario than when you buy a hunting parcel that maybe doesn't have, you know, even if it's got tillable on it, you still never cover. Like,
yeah, but a good rec farm's like you're found a deal if you can get 3% appreciate or 3% return on a rec farm like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why it just doesn't, you know, that's why to me a duplex comes first in building, you know, building a mini real estate empire that, you know, has the equity and has some cash flow and then buying, you know, the farm to me makes sense. But I would tell you to just do, you know, go do both in a small way, you know, go buy that $70,000 there. I mean, there are still parcels that hit that are $100,000, in some of these areas, and go buy that, you know, that out of state or, you know, buy that kind of, your mini version of your dream farm and go do it both, as I guess what I would say.
And so as part of the strategy behind buying the duplex first so now you have cash flow coming from the duplex and then you save up money or maybe you do a cash out refinance on that property and then you go buy the $100,000 farm to basically have those rental payments help pay for the farm. Is that the thought process behind that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, a farm costs me money, right? Like I don't make my monthly payments don't get paid, largely speaking. I mean, you know, calculate the timber value. I mean, you know, you can make the argument for a while, your farm will pay for your monthly payment. But for the most part, the farms that I have bought, the big wins have all been on, you know, appreciation/land improvement. So if you're not specifically going in there to improve land and flip, like you're buying this as a buy and hold, that hunting farm is probably not going to make you money. It's just going to cost you money as it appreciates in value. So it's equity growth. So I think really that's what it comes down to is, are you after making money? Like if you're making cash, or are you just after growing, you know, equity? If equity growth, I mean, if you said to me, is buying land or investing in the stock market, you know, which one of those would you do? I would tell you all day long, go buy that hunting farm. One, the bank will actually loan you money. They're not going to loan you money to go buy Bitcoin. Right. I like Bitcoin as well, yeah. By the way, but nobody's loaning you money to do that. You know, and they will loan you money to buy a hunting. So, you know, your $20,000 down is going to go a lot farther in real estate. So I'm always going to push real estate, but it would be a very individual scenario of, do I buy the rental house or do I buy the hunting farm? So I give you
$500,000. How are you deploying that between Bitcoin, rental properties, and land? And you got to spend it in the next, or Bitcoin's near an all time high, right? So this is like, Calvin, you have one week to spend $500,000. Go do it. Go wild. How are you going to deploy those dollars?
I would go buy two finance properties. I would go buy $1 million commercial property with $250,000 down. That is a low cash flow, but very strong tenant, good building. And then I would go buy that hunting farm. That I'd go buy that $1 million hunting farm with my other 25% down, and I would do that. I would do that type sort of 50-50 ratio. Okay. There. So our business, I don't know what our percentages are. I mean, we definitely hold more in commercial ground, you know, commercial cash flowing properties than we do in hunting ground. So I know the hunting, the investing in land and farms is not just, it's, you know, this is not a fun money thing. This is, we believe that land appreciation will occur for a good long time or for forever. And that's, you know, that's buying large acreage parcels, which, I mean, we're getting to the point where anything over 20 acres is big. Whereas when our grandparents were around, I mean, 200 acres wasn't even big. So just that just seeing where in one or two generations land has gone. It just, I want a lot, I want 20 to 30% of our portfolio to be land holdings. And obviously hunting is my favorite thing to do. It's the perfect combo for what I enjoy most, which is probably land and whitetails. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but no Bitcoin in that mix.
No, I, you know, the funny thing is I think I bought a couple grand worth of Bitcoin today. I've been buying all the way up, but not, you know, just not large. I mean, you sure, we'll put 10 grand in that 500 okay. grand of Bitcoin.
Okay.
So,
okay. Yeah. So you've been,
that's it though.
I've been dollar.
I didn't buy in big on Bitcoin. I had buddies who did. I did buy some at like 8 grand and 11 grand. And I thought I was buying in pretty high then. And I don't know what it's at, like 66 or something today. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been dollar cost averaging most of the year. I have not gone down that wormhole, but I do
think when we get smoked, I mean, you know, what do you think, you know, if our economy gets something big happens, which it will at some point, you know, what do you think, rec land, you know, values do to compared to say other real estate? Do you think they get hurt more than other real estate, or do you think that they've proved they could weather the storm?
I think it would be hyper localized, honestly. Like you're in Michigan, and I would say you guys got hit by the housing crisis 08-09 harder than probably anyone. And then mm-hmm. you go to other parts of the country. So I think it would be hyper localized depending on just local economies and everything else. I think, and maybe major depressed areas that it could get beat up. And then I think the edge of town or like within an hour of a metro area, it'll go down, but I don't think it'll be as drastic as some of the other areas. And like you could make that same argument even in the housing market this year. San Francisco has gotten beat up with their housing. And then if you look at some other parts in the country, houses are still appreciating. So I think it'd be hyper localized. And I think that's the essence of having a good agent, but I wish I knew, and I wish I could hedge some giant bet, but I'm guessing just like everyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. And I think there's been uncertainty in the market almost in every turn since COVID, really. Right. People thought it was going to go down, and then inflation was really high. And then some really smart people are saying, well, land's the best hedge against inflation. So then a lot of money went into land, and then people, well, interest rates are going up, so land's going to go down. And then you look at auction results and they're still going really strong. So I don't know.
I had a couple friends I can think of specific points. So like there about 2011, 12 here, everybody was fairly confident in real estate, and rentals were, instead of being 30 grand, they were 50 grand. And so lots of people I know just started, you know, buying up rentals. People were moving back into West Michigan rather than out of West Michigan. Everything was getting really healthy, but stuff was still cheap. And then I think in 2017, I had, you know, a buddy like sell his entire portfolio, and a lot of people sold out in like 17, 18, 19, expecting, and then just like sat on that cash to wait, you know, for that crash they knew was coming. And then it just boomed, you know, and that cash is so, you know, I don't want to say worthless, but became worth so much less than if they had hung on to that. So that's what, I mean, real estate is such a, you know, a fun thing, but yeah, you do, you know, you go buy that hunting farm and then it lowers in value. Like you have to have the income to hang on to that, to weather the storm. So it will rebound in value. It's just, you know, you just don't know when.
Yeah. What I've been telling clients here a lot this year is I would look at any buy as probably a 3 to 5 year hold. Like I would go into that thinking I can weather whatever storm for 3 to 5 years. And that's my general consensus. I know it's kind of vague, but there's a lot of guys that have been spoiled here the last couple of years where they bought something and, you know, it's appreciated $1,000 an acre in a pretty short amount of time. And so I think that would be my advice overall. I mean, a good buy is still a good buy, right? Like you can make money in a good market. You can make money in a bad market too, but that's my advice for someone that, you know, maybe doesn't have a huge financial moat, but you know, put pen to paper and feel really confident and have enough conviction that you want to hold on to this thing for 3 years. You might not need to, and you might be able to upgrade sooner, but that's how I would look at it. And that's localized too. I mean, that advice may change in different parts of the country. There's some parts of the country that's appreciating really fast. And then there's some other places where I think land values are going to be flat or up a couple points or possibly down a couple points, but it's dynamic.
Yeah, I assume most of your listeners are probably in the Midwest, and I mean, to me, the Midwest feels healthy, and I mean, just tillable land, wooded land. You know, for example, like we're not terribly far from Columbus, Ohio, where we're buying in Ohio, and Columbus, Ohio is just boom town. Like, you know, 100 acres right around Columbus is going to cost you a fortune, and you know, but we're another hour out. So like when, you know, I'm not saying we're going to become a suburb of Columbus. That's not what I'm saying, but it's going to affect the towns. You know, some of the towns around Columbus are actually pretty impoverished still, you know, when those towns, you know, rebound. So I'm very much looking, you know, I don't like to be labeled as somebody who flips stuff because I'm only flipping, you know, a hunting farm to buy a bigger hunting farm. And I am in the long-term, you know, buy and hold game largely, you know, in Midwest states. And I still believe that buying something at 5, 6, 7 grand an acre, I don't know, what is it by you? Probably more like 10 plus an acre.
No, not, I mean, it depends on the size and everything, but I would say your average recreational piece. Well, I just looked at a report here not too long ago. And so in 2022, the average recreational price, so that's a blended average of maybe a little bit of tillable or pure timber tracts. The average was 5,500 an acre. That was the blended average. And, you know, you go to one county or one township, it's going to vary, but that's the blended average. And I think you make a really good point about Columbus growing. And I think everyone listening can think of the metro area, whatever's closest to them. As Columbus continues to grow, right? And more money goes into it, more infrastructure gets in place. That piece that's an hour-ish or 2 hours away from Columbus, that buyer pool of recreational ground is going to grow, and therefore it's going to appreciate.
And that is exactly what happened. So that first farm, I think I bought little pieces before this, but if I can say about my first farm, so to speak, was that 77 acre piece, and it was 45 minutes from, so I'm in a town called Sparta, which is just north of Grand Rapids. You know, I bought, and Grand Rapids is boom town too. I mean, it's just always growing, high ratings on places to live or affordability to live on Forbes or whatever. West Michigan's probably the most successful part of Michigan. And with that piece 45 minutes away, I mean, I could tell the appreciation on paper for what things said was like 15%. I mean, I experienced like, you know, insanely above that. So that's where you get that specific to a market. I think I bought it for about 77 acres for 220,000. I parceled off 17 acres and got, this is going to be hard for me to remember the exact numbers. I think I parceled off 17 acres and got 120,000 for the 17 acres. And then the remaining 60 acres, this is like a year and a half ish later, I think I got 280,000 for that remaining thing. So I think I invested around 220, didn't do a lot of improvement, just kind of split it up how it should have probably been split up. Somewhere, I mean, obviously you got closing costs, a lot of closing and holding costs in there, but to go from really from 220 to like 400 in the matter of like a year and a half. I mean, that's largely appreciation and a couple of the right decisions of doing the survey and the split and having the road frontage to, you know, to do that, and buying it, right? But I mean, that was, you know, that was not an off market deal. That was a, that was an on market, deal. So we, I believe we had that one under contract within like, I think we had it verbally under contract within like 8 hours of it hitting the market. So,
right.
There's two, that was what made that one special probably.
Yeah. A couple good points. Number one, the good deals go fast. So don't sit on your heels. And when you see a good deal, jump on it. Like it can be that simple. Now, obviously there's a lot of prep work to know what is a good deal and what's an okay deal and everything in between. And then another thing that you brought up, and I'm probably going to draw a blank now because I lost my second thought here. You mentioned this isn't it, but just in general, Warren Buffett has a quote, and I'm going to botch it, but he talks about like there's a guy, or maybe it was Charlie Munger, but talking about like those who think they can time the market and then those who just know you can't time the market. And I think that that is very, very, very important, because if you and I could have timed the market, that would dictate all of our decisions. But
it would. Yeah. I mean, when crypto, I feel like became a really big thing, what, like, I don't know, 7 years ago, something like that. Like it was making waves. I mean, I made a little bit of money in it, and then I put a good chunk of change at it and pretty much lost it all. You know, it's just, and that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to time all this fake, you know, I'm not saying all crypto is fake, but the bull runs that these things were making were fake and they were inflated. And I wasn't the big player in the game to, you know, dictate what those, you know, what those things were. So, yeah, I mean, that's why I love buy and hold. I mean, you know, I wish I could keep every house we flip. You know, I can't. That's how we produce dollars to buy stuff to hold. You know, but I love holding real estate more than I think I love purchasing. I love buying real estate more than I like selling it. So, but it will be interesting to, you know, I mean, like I said, I started investing in 2009. Every year has gone up, you know, from that point. It's either been flat. I mean, there hardly has been a flat year. It's hardly been a year that it didn't go up at least 8 to 10%. So our generation has not weathered the storm of a major market pullback. So that's, you know, that's, it's like you can build all these things. What does it look like? You know, we have to answer those questions of how do we prepare for, that market pullback. So it's been fun to grow, but you know, I think there's the how do we grow and then how do we preserve, you know, plan as well. So, and that's what we're looking at. Yeah. What is that, you know, what is that highest debt to income or the highest, debt to value, you know, range that I, you know, that we're comfortable in type things. Mm-hmm. You have to answer those questions.
Yeah. Those are really important. I have, this, early next week, I have a conversation scheduled with a father and son, and the father he went bankrupt in the 80s farm crisis, bought 600 acres, farmed 600 acres, went absolutely bankrupt, and then ended up buying some more stuff. So I've been wanting to get someone like that on this podcast so bad, because to your point, we, like you and I, we haven't experienced a catastrophic downturn, but he did. So I'll be very curious to talk with him. And then a couple other points that came back to me. One of them I think is really important. You mentioned about 60% of the farms you guys have bought have been listed. And I think some people think like all the good deals are because of this, that, and the other. And I don't have the network to get something like that, or I'm not lucky enough to do that. But over half of them, anyone listening could have found it and could have bought it. I mean, to me, that should feel a little empowering to everyone listening. Like, hey, here's a guy that has done a lot of deals, and over half of them have been listed to the public on the internet. Anyone in the world could have bought it.
Yeah. I mean, identify that area. You know, I mean, I keep pointing to Southeast Ohio. Now you're all, now everybody's going to come by in Southeast Ohio and inflate the values, which is good, sure, which is good. Let me pick up a few more parcels and then you guys can all come. So, I think identify, you know, I think from a hunting farm standpoint, kind of goes back to the question you asked of, you know, kind of tips on buying that. I would almost say, how far out am I willing to drive for a hunting, you know, farm, the day trip thing? I mean, is it the day trip thing? Do I want to do the day trip thing inside of, you know, whatever, an hour and a half? Do I want to do the 6 to 7 hour thing? I mean, I would love to go to Kansas. I would love, you know, Kansas has always been a dream of mine. I'm just not going to, you know, it just doesn't, the whole like hours, one full hours. Day drive just doesn't make sense. So that's why you've seen me kind of, I mean, Illinois is probably the only like state I have not hit for, like within the sphere of Michigan here. So, you know, but I think just identify what you want to do. If you're willing to do the 6 hour thing, you know, go see like this. Okay. Let's go back to that $70,000 piece, 35 acres. This piece has, it had a house. It's got power to a pole. It's got water. It's got, so I bought a piece that, I mean, we just demo the trailer. You can pull your camper, you know, you can go buy a $10,000 camper, and for 80 grand, you've got, for really a $10,000 down payment and your $5,000, $5,000 to $10,000 camper, you have a beautiful deer camp. And we killed 3 deer. None of them are giants, but we killed 3 deer on there. And the 165 inch deer that was on there did, you know, he got away. So like, and he'll, you know, we got pictures of him late. So he should be, you know, there should be 180 inch deer on there this year, maybe, or bigger. So, you know, that's that piece was on market for 99,000. So you'll probably hate me as an agent for saying this, but don't be afraid to lowball. Don't be afraid to lowball some things either. Don't just look at a farm, see where it's priced. And, you know, so I always do both things. I probably like to hit properties on like the day they're listed and be really aggressive, get my offer in right away, negotiate hard right away. Be very, when you know something's a deal, be very aggressive, be willing to, you know, go over, ask and waive. I mean, again, we're in the house flipping, but we're very quick to waive in all inspections. You know, we just kind of underwrite, okay, what are all the potential expenses if that could hit us? You know, so be aggressive on those good deals, but you know, those pieces that have been on market 30, 60 days that have some hair on the deal, like just go, you know, go lowball them. And I think finding an agent, you know, finding an agent who's willing, like who calls you back very quickly, aggressively hits that on market deal, and being willing to work with an agent who's not willing to, who doesn't care if they're like write some offensive offers, offensively low offers, or who can feel navigate that path really well. Mm-hmm. You know, those are valuable things to have. So that's probably the two like on market strategies that we've taken. Like right now we're buying a piece in Ohio that is a house. I think it's a house and 70 acres. You know, and we got the math figured out on what's the house on 5 acres worth. And so just an agent that's competent of map, and agents are highly motivated to do that because they're getting multiple listings out of it. There's agents that we work with that we do a ton of business. I mean, they, you know, to the point where they could probably, you know, probably get an income, an annual income of like just off our business. So you do a couple deals with an agent and you'll get a highly motivated friend who's, you know, who's really advocating for you.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. One other question I had to kind of wrap things up. Are you 1031 in a lot of these farms, or do you do a blend, or does it depend? What's your strategy behind that?
Yeah, you know, to date, we've only sold like 5 or 6 actual farms. And I think I have only done like 3 or 4 1031s in my life. And usually that's been commercial to commercial, or residential to commercial, something like that. One of my favorite things to do with land is to, you know, you want to check with your CPA on how to handle this as tax basis. But if I buy a farm and let's say I sell the more valuable half, and you know, after improving, and I'm hesitant to sell that last chunk or that last half of land, so to speak, because that's when the big taxable gain is going to hit me. So again, you have to like talk to your CPA. Don't rely on my tax advice, but you're able to, if you keep part of the land, you're able to structure a deal pretty in your tax favor. Again, there's some gray lines or some legal, not legal things of how to do that. But, you know, you buy 50 acres, you sell 30 of it. So some guys don't like hanging on to 20, you know, it's either dream farm or nothing. For me, again, I'm quantity. I'd rather have, you know, a handful of spots, to hunt. If I could buy 5 acres in Southeast Ohio, that's probably a better hunting spot than anywhere where I'm going to hunt,
50
you know,
acres
around my hometown right here. So yeah. I probably have a higher likelihood of shooting a big deer, you know, there. And even if it's on a bait pile, I mean, here, there's no baiting in Michigan. And whereas there you can, I think you can dump a dump truck of corn if you wanted to. So, so, you know, yeah, that's, so I guess I've been hesitant. I would probably have done more 1031s if I hadn't kept parts of parcels.
Sure.
So to speak. So I highly value a 1031. They're affordable to do. I've usually been able to find the property and either identify the property as I go to sell the one. So I think I've done like 3 or 4 1031s. And it is an important, you know, component of dodging taxes legally. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's that call it, it's crazy of how complex 1031s can be. It's, I mean, there's specialists. That's all they do is 1031s.
And yeah.
Go schedule.
Where we've dodged taxes more, so to speak, has been on buying commercial buildings and doing the cost segregation studies, mm-hmm. Which I believe was 80% last year and 100% like the years previous. I think there's a tax bill in Congress right now to pass that again at 100%. So, and more or less, yeah, what that is just taking, you know, advancing the depreciation. So you're able to take that huge expense that first year. Mm-hmm. And myself as a real estate professional can take that full, or that's how I'm taxed. So I can take that full amount. So we're more likely to buy a commercial building, do a cost segregation study, and that actually offsets the taxable gain on like flipping a land parcel. Yeah.
That's
for that year, you know, and then, so then next year we try to do the same thing again.
Yeah.
I try to not pay taxes in a,
yeah, no one
in a legal way.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, that's a really interesting strategy that I know has not been covered here on the podcast. So I definitely,
that's why I like to blend. Yeah. I never would be all land again, yeah. Like land. I wish corn and bean prices would go through the roof, and I wish farming, you know, some days I wish I could be a farmer. Like I always think I have no farming background. I'm sure I'd be terrible at it, but I love the concept of farming and land producing food and you know, so when, you know, I don't know, when corn and beef, you know, goes through the roof, and those things would make land more, you know, more valuable. But in, you know, that's where commercial real estate, residential real estate just has these, you know, everything's fairly, you know, not perfectly predictable, but you know, we can produce an income, you know, off of those things, and then play that tax game that's hard to play with just buying, mm-hmm. buying land.
So. Yeah. Well, no, that's really exciting. Give me a call when you want to get in Illinois and finish the Midwest, tie all the states together. But if anything else you want to share, and then we'll wrap it up.
I don't think so. I appreciate a lot of the, I've learned some things off of your podcast, and just appreciate the opportunity to do this. And you asked some great questions, and I think always be evaluating those, you know, the business and the purchases. And I love land and excited to buy more of it, you know, concerned and excited for what the future might hold over these next few years on land. So
I love it. Well, usually I give people the opportunity to share contact information. You're welcome to do that. If you don't want to, that's fine too. Or maybe someone has a dilapidated house in Michigan they want to sell. So it's up to you.
Yeah, we don't have, we don't have, you know, much of a need for marketing. Agents usually do most of that for us. Our business is fairly, you know, in the background, and agents are marketing for sales and buy. But if you want to reach out to me, it's just my name at gmail.com. So just KelvinBeakey@gmail.com. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much, Calvin. I really appreciate it. Learned a lot. Have a page of notes. And thanks for coming on here.
Thanks, Jake.
There you guys have it. Hope you guys enjoyed this episode. If you did, share it with a friend. And don't forget to go over to ExodusOutdoorGear.com, support the Land Podcast, support Exodus, and use the code 4K, the number 4, the letter K, to save $50 and pre-order our new non-cellular trail camera. This is the creme de la creme of standard cameras. 4K native video, breathtaking photos, breathtaking videos, just an exceptional camera. We're using 18650 batteries, and you're going to save over $200 in batteries over the lifespan of this product. So it literally pays for itself just by using 18650 batteries and not having to buy AA lithium batteries. So hope you guys have a great rest of your week. We'll talk with you next week, and I'll give you a quick teaser. Next week is one of my favorite episodes I think I've ever had the pleasure of recording for the Land Podcast. That's all I'm going to say. It's going to really hit home, and I think it's just a very special conversation. I'm lucky that I was able to have it. That's all I'll say. Hope you guys have a great week. See ya.